Well, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Soleri Report Lawrence Gonzalez, who is a very successful journalist and author focused very much on extreme experiences and survival experiences. Lawrence is no stranger to the Soleri Report. We did a Soleri Report several years ago on deep survival, which is one of my favorite books. I recommend it to everyone. And so Lawrence has published several new books and has one coming out that is very exciting. So it's my pleasure to welcome him today to the Soleri Report. Lawrence, are you with us?
I am with you. Thank you very much for inviting me back.
Well, it's our pleasure. So I wanted to go back and revisit and introduce Deep Survival and the basic premise. It's a book I try and get everyone to read because I think it has enormous application in every person's life and is sort of one of those unbelievably authentic, invaluable things that you haven't thought deeply about, but you need to. So if you could just take us back, describe how it was you came to write Deep Survival, what it's about, and what the message of the book is.
Well, my interest in this began, I think, when I was a little kid, and I heard stories about my father, who was a combat pilot in World War II, and he was shot down. And essentially, the story is he fell 27,000 feet without a parachute and survived. And as a little kid, this is a very compelling idea. And so I, at a very early age, began to wonder, well, why does one person survive and another doesn't in the same situation? In my father's case, I think it was luck, but it set me on the road to researching this. And by about the 1990s, there was a whole lot of neuroscience, brain research coming out that told us how certain things work in the brain. And I began to realize therein lies the answers to my questions. So why do we get ourselves into trouble in the first place? That's like the first half of Deep Survival. And the second half is, once we've gotten ourselves into trouble, how do we get out? And who survives? The subhead of the book is who lives, who dies, and why. And that's really what the book is about. And in the end of the book, there are some lessons for people that illustrate 12 traits of survivors that people can actually practice in their lives and do better, not just in surviving a life-threatening event, but do better in general, just making decisions.
One of the things, you know, the Deep Survival, the first thing I should say is Deep Survival is beautifully written. You are someone who writes, you're just a beautiful writer. You've mastered your craft plus some. And so when you go through the descriptions of the different wilderness experiences, it's really like you're there. You know, you're really on the cliff, you're hanging there. It's very, it's certainly very entertaining in that way.
Well, thank you.
But you come out with a set of sort of 10 lessons, and we, or sort of 10 takeaways, best practices, I would say. And I link to one of your articles in the, if you look at the blog post on the Soleri Report we did, it's linked. But what I discovered is that the things that cause people to survive an extreme wilderness experience are the things that cause people to succeed, I think, in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
They're the same, you know, they really, you know, you see them play out in an extreme circumstance. So they're somehow it brings the lesson home emotionally. But maybe you could just talk quickly about what some of the lessons learned were.
Well, it's interesting because although I use a lot of episodes from wilderness events as examples, the most popular venues I have for speaking engagements are people who take risks of other kinds, like doctors who treat cancer, financial analysts who invest other people's money, bankers, businessmen. They are all drawn to this stuff because, as you say, it's lessons in life. My kids and I joked about naming the book The Rules of Life. But so in the end of the book, I actually call this chapter The Rules of Adventure. because so many of these stories are from wilderness adventures. But there are 12 rules that I give. And the first one is perceive, believe. It means don't enter into denial. You know, when trouble comes, and it always does, one of the biggest stumbling blocks for people is that they tend to deny that it's happening. And
right.
So the good survivor will admit, like, you know what, I really am lost. I really don't know what's going on. Or my marriage really is in trouble. Or I really do have these symptoms. I better go see a doctor. So that's a big one, perceiving and believing, becoming a believer in your own vulnerability. The second thing is, of course, when you find out you're in trouble, the impulse is to panic. So the second rule is stay calm and use your fear to focus. Use your fear to make you angry enough to do something about it. So these are steps that lead toward action. The third thing is think, analyze, plan. So if you're staying calm, you're able to think. If you're too excited, you can't think. So the survivor makes a plan because he's going to ultimately do something about his troubles. And that's the next step, take correct, decisive action. So it's all well and good to think about things, but you have to actually do something. Celebrate your success. So along the way, the survivor takes little steps and he has little celebrations to reward himself, to keep himself motivated. So it goes on. There are 12 of them. If you want, I can go through all of them.
No, we can link to the, you know, there's a link to the article from the last blog post. So, and we'll link to it again in the subscriber links.
Right.
One of the things that struck me in Surviving Survival, The Art and Science of Resilience, one of your newer ones, I was reading the story of the woman who she and her husband were attacked by a bear.
Right.
And again, it was a remarkable, you know, you've done this several times in the two books where you tell the story of someone whose intuition is telling them there's something wrong.
Right.
And for a variety of reasons, they override that intuition. You know, they, in this case, the husband's poo-pooing it, or, you know, but they don't listen to their intuition.
Right.
And I was struck again this weekend as I read this with, well, let me ask you, have you become, since studying all these things and writing all these things, have you become better at listening to your intuition?
Gee, I hope so. You know, this goes way back for me. In 1979, my first novel was coming out, and I was supposed to go to Los Angeles for the book fair, the booksellers convention, to promote my book. And a bunch of colleagues were going. And at the time, I was studying aviation accidents, and I discovered that we were supposed to get on this DC-10 to go to Los Angeles together, and I just didn't like the DC-10. I just really had done some research and had some bad feelings about it, and my gut told me, just, you know, get another flight. This is not.
Did you tell them? Did you ever tell them?
Yeah, I told them, and they poo-pooed me about it, you know, like, oh, come on. You know, it's just a flight to L.A. It was a DC-10, American Flight 191. It crashed after 30 seconds of flight, and everyone was killed.
Ugh.
So
I remember reading that story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My colleagues were on that flight, and I was not. And so I do take this business of gut feelings seriously, and I try to be attuned to it. It's a difficult thing, you know, because it can be paralyzing if you take it too much in the wrong direction. But there's another story in Surviving Survival about a soldier, Chris Lawrence, who gets blown up because he doesn't listen to his inner voice. And so, yes, I think we should practice that.
At one point you call it the stream, which I love.
Yes, the stream. So I have a novel that was published by Alfred A. Knopf. It's called Lucy, and it's a sort of coming-of-age novel about a teenage girl, but she's actually only half human. And so this whole fantasy story is, which is very popular among teenagers, by the way, is about this girl's trials and tribulations and coming of age. And she, because she's only half human, has these animal qualities that are very important to the story, and she can enter into the stream and communicate it at a higher level than humans can. And although I made that up for the book, it's actually true. There's a level at which we communicate and a level at which we perceive that's really not conscious, and it's hard to bring it to consciousness, and it results in gut feelings. And so we're constantly getting these signals from our environment and from others in the environment. We just are not very practiced in our culture at paying attention to them.
I was in the 90s, I was at a business dinner and turned to the fellow on my right and basically said to him, you know, sort of, who are you and what are you doing? And he was a young insurance executive from Scandinavia, and he was in charge of doing their research on how memories come from the future.
Really?
And I thought, well, if the actuaries take this seriously, I'm going to.
And it's, I mean, there's just too much, although it's anecdotal, there's just too much evidence in my view. And now there's starting to be much more evidence that's hard science, like the neuroscientists are studying people's brains, and they can see stuff happening basically before it happens.
Right.
And so there really is a huge subterranean piece of our brain that we don't get access to, but that deals out messages to our body.
So remarkable. Okay, Surviving Survival, The Art and Science of Resilience. Why and how did you come to write this?
Well, so Deep Survival tells the stories it tells from the point of view of the survivor, or the person who perishes in cases where the person doesn't survive. But it always ends with either the death or the rescue. And the fact of the matter is that when you go through a big traumatic experience like that and get out alive, that's not the end of the story. That's the beginning of a much more dramatic story, really, in that you have to somehow get your life back. So if you go get shipwrecked and, you know, have to be floating at sea for weeks and weeks fighting for your life, when you get home, you can't just step back into your life. You're not going to be the same person. And so Surviving Survival examines two big questions. One is, why does that happen? How does it happen? What's going on in your brain when that happens? We all are familiar with PTSD, but what exactly is it, and why is it the way it is? And then the second thing is, what can you do about it? So Surviving Survival is actually a sequel to Deep Survival, and takes off with, first of all, making you understand that you're not crazy. These things are real, and they do take place in your brain. And secondly, giving you some tools to cope with those things so that you don't, so that you can get on with your life.
You know, it's funny. I kept thinking as I was reading this, you know, I've never been a person who was particularly adept at school. And I got a college degree and a graduate degree, and I found it to be a very traumatic and stressful experience, but I got something for it that's been useful ever since.
Uh-huh.
You know, I got a diploma and I got credentials. It's almost though we need you to start an institute to credential. You know, it's almost like you need to prove you got something out of it.
Yeah.
Because in fact, you know, the experience can be one that can be extraordinarily informative and useful in future life, but it's almost like you don't get the credential. One of the things I was struck, there were numerous, you know, your book has many scribbles in it. But one of the first things I wanted to touch on is the reaction of alienation and displacement, you called it.
Right. Well, when you go through a traumatic experience, all kinds of things change. You're learning a lesson. We are tremendous learning machines. And from birth, even before birth, our brains and bodies are busy learning about our environment and learning about the other creatures in our environment and storing all this information away. It's now thought that people really don't forget anything. that we remember everything. It's just that our conscious minds have limited capacity, so we stick stuff back where we can't retrieve it anymore. So in something like trauma, it's very important that the brain record this stuff, that it associated with certain bodily feelings, and that we have the sensory equipment to sense anything that may be related to this kind of danger for the future, so that we can survive. So in the case of the couple who was attacked by the bear that you mentioned, the woman used to love the smell of pine. When the bear attacked, they were in the woods in the Canadian Rockies, and she came away from that experience unable to control her emotions when she was in the presence of the smell of pine. She had panic attacks whenever she smelled pine. The smell of pine had been conveniently paired in the brain and body with this traumatic experience of the bear. So the brain is constantly pairing up all kinds of things that you're not aware of, and this develops a tremendous array of what they call triggers to set you off. And it can set you off in a good way, too. So for me, the smell of roses takes me back to my grandmother's house in San Antonio when I was a kid because she liked to grow roses.
Right.
So this is the sort of underpinning of the whole book, really. It's about the way the brain and body work to, first of all, disturb us when we go through trauma, and then, if we use it right, if we know the tricks, to make us feel better in the aftermath of trauma.
Now, one theme that came up again and again and again, which I just loved, was the importance of being useful.
Right.
To converting your experience into something that turned into a successful life for you.
Right. Yes, and I talk about this in in Deep Survival, too. So you can choose to be a victim or you can choose to be a rescuer. That's essentially what this is about. And simply by finding someone who's worse off than you are and helping that person, you can experience an almost immediate relief of whatever is troubling you because you're forced to do something for someone else. So it is often the case in big traumatic events that you find a certain subgroup of people who have these traumatic experiences will go into a helping profession afterwards. They'll go off, you know, volunteering at disasters, or they'll become psychotherapists, or in some other, you know, volunteer at the local hospital, in the children's cancer ward, or whatever. And it does take you out of yourself. It's a very helpful thing to do. And you can't, our conscious brains are so limited in their capacity that we can't sit around feeling sorry for ourselves when we're concentrating on helping someone else.
One of your great quotes, and I resonated with this, when I worked in the federal government, I had little buttons made up that said no whining.
Uh-huh.
And it was literally, I worked in an agency where everybody whined, and it got in the way of getting things done because you needed people to tell you what actions they needed you to take to get them out of their predicament. And if that took 20 minutes of working through the whine, you'd never get there.
Yeah.
So I was trying to communicate to them sort of how, you know, a strategy for getting things changed. So we had these no whining buttons made. And the next thing you know, everybody at OMB loved me because all the other agencies wanted them. And you could tell how bad things were around Washington according to who wanted how many no whining buttons. It was very funny. But you have this great line. Wait, let me see if I can find it again. It says, those who survive waste little time whining.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
One of the first things that comes up in these situations is, you know what? Here you are. Guess what? You got yourself lost. Now what? You know, what's the next right thing to do?
Right. Exactly. Another one I wanted to bring up was, this is again personal. I went through a period of litigating with the federal government that got very violent and sort of, you know, just very difficult. And ever since then, I've always loved to travel, but ever since then, I'm a traveling, You know, since then I've put about 500,000 miles on different cars traveling around the country. A lot of my, I need to do due diligence for business, and so I travel. And one of the things you write about is, let me use your quote, travel is a time-honored strategy for healing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes. Wow, you're right.
Yes, it is. And in Surviving Survival, I talk about Ann Hood, who lost her little daughter. And it destroyed her life, really. And she had to really work hard to get her life back. And part of her strategy was traveling. She would just leave town and go to Europe with her husband, and they would just walk all over the place. Walking is a time-honored strategy for relieving suffering as well. I go into that in the book.
Uh-huh. The another one is, let me just read it. We evolved to live in small groups of 150 or so people. Within these groups, we lived in even smaller and more intimate groups of 30 or 50. And nesting within those, we lived in smaller groups made up of our extended families and friends. There was a kind of stability in this manner of living that we don't have in the modern city, where we're constantly exposed to hundreds or even thousands of strangers, faces upon faces. And then you go into coming out of a survival experience, how the security of those kinds of groupings can make a difference.
Yes.
It's almost like we need to go back to community.
Yes, exactly. And people who are socially well-connected, intimately connected with other people in the family or circle of friends, just do better in these survival situations than in both the survival situations I talk about in Deep Survival, because they have something worth getting back to, and the aftermath of the survival situation, because they have all of the emotional connection and emotional support of the people around them.
It's funny you say that. I never forget. As a child, I was required to read the New York Times every day. And I don't know if you remember, they used to have a science, I don't know if they still do it, they'd have a science page on Wednesday. And I'll never forget, I think I was in high school, reading a story about scientists who took two groups of rats. And one group of rats, they just fed whatever they wanted, and they had the life of Riley, and they were lazy, they never exercised, they just ate and got fat. And the other, you know, got conditioned and did lots of running around and was required to train and everything else. And then they took the two groups of rats and they put them in water to see how long they would swim before they gave up and die. And the rats that had worked hard and done endurance training gave up almost immediately and died. And the rats that were fat and unexercised swam forever because they had something really wonderful to look forward to if they could make it. It was their theory. I said, oh, okay. That tells something.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the last chapter of Surviving Survival, you describe the rules of life.
Uh-huh.
So you bring it back to 12, and maybe if we could go through those quickly, I think this is really a terrific chapter.
Well, thank you. Yes, we can go through those.
So, you want me to do it?
Well, either way, it's fine with me. I was just opening the book.
Oh, okay.
Wanted, needed, have it. That's the first item on the list, and it is something that my eldest daughter, Elena, used to say when she was about 2 years old. And she would ask for something. She'd say, want it, need it, have it. And it always stuck with me because it's so intimately human, so quintessentially human. And in order to get past your traumatic experience, you have to be passionate about something. You have to want something in your life. A lot of us pre-trauma can go just sort of coast through life, not really deciding what we care about the most, or what we're really passionate about. Some people are inherently passionate, you know, all their lives, but many people just don't know what they want. And a traumatic experience will torture you and force you to decide what it is you really want.
Right.
And if you're ever going to get out of it. And the second thing is be here now. This is another thing that my kids and I talked about all the time. It's like, it's mindfulness. It's being aware of your surroundings, aware of what you're actually doing, thinking about things more deeply than you normally do. It means be quiet. It means take time every day to tune out all the electronic noise and the chattering voices that clamor for our attention. I'm reading from the book now. And then listen to your own mind and body. So this is getting in the stream. Putting in this effort to pay attention means that you'll be much more likely to seize opportunities and avoid hazards. The third thing is be patient. We live in a culture that is instant gratification all the time, especially with all our new iPhones and Facebooks and all that. Be patient, because these things take time. If you really have gone through a traumatic experience and you want to get better, you're going to have to live with it for a while you work on it. It's what one of my friends calls a hard work miracle. You can get out of it, but it takes hard work. The fourth item is be tough. One of the things that Viktor Frankl is a famous psychiatrist who was in Auschwitz and nearly died there, but did survive and wrote about it afterwards. And he wrote about the learning to suffer well, learning the art of suffering. Well, when we go through traumatic experiences, we suffer in the wake of them. And so that's part of our job, not to suffer eternally, but to at least get through it. The fifth item is get the small picture. You suffer, but you don't have to suffer all the time. And again, this is from a Nazi death camp. There's a wonderful book called The Last Expression, Art and Auschwitz. And it shows all of the art that was made secretly inside the death camps. And it's an amazing thing how these people who were suffering so much could produce such wonderful art. And so, you know, it's a lesson for us when we are suffering. And again, it helps to find someone who's worse off than you are. And certainly,
right.
I think somebody in a Nazi death camp is about as worse off as it can get.
Yep.
The sixth thing is put things in their place. Traumatic memories don't go away. They stay with us even when we learn to live with them and cope with them. But there's a way to set them in a context so that we can move past them. My wife, Debbie, had cervical cancer when she was young, and she had a hysterectomy on May 18th when she was 27. And so she never was able to have children, and it was always a sad day for her. But when we decided to get married, I said, let's get married on May 18th. That'll be our anniversary, and it no longer will be a sad day for you. So that's what we did. That's what we did, and now
Did it work?
Yeah, sure, it did. Actually,
there you go.
We've taken some of our best trips to include May 18th, like we went to Italy one year and France another year. And so May 18th has come to be a real fun date for us.
Mm-hmm.
So let's put things in their place. Seven is work, work, work. So people who go through trauma have to do something. And everyone has a different way of doing this. In the case of Ann Hood, we mentioned she lost her little 5-year-old daughter and went crazy. She took up knitting, and she found that knitting, the act of knitting in a group of people, calmed her down. And some days, she said, when she was first trying to get through this, she would knit all day long for like 8 hours and do nothing else. And she's written about this. And, of course, when I first heard this, I thought, knitting? Seriously? But it turns out there are tricks you can play on the brain, and this is one of them, to do something that is patterned, repetitive, rhythmic. This is why walking helps people who are traumatized. But you can use all kinds of things. A game of golf for one of the people I write about is what calmed his brain down. And many other things. I think for me it's writing, to tell you the truth. But it does the same thing to the brain in all of these
things. Right.
Eight, see one, do one, teach one. That's what neurosurgeons say. They're talking about operations. When they're teaching the students, they say, see one, do one, teach one. And that's how you learn to do it. And so while you're doing your work, you receive benefits. But then as you pass this along to someone else, you receive benefits. and hoods, you know, had been knitting for a couple of years when a woman called her. She was a woman whose son had gone to the same grade school as Ann Hood's daughter who died, and the woman called Ann to tell her that her son had died. And Ann said, come over to my house, I'm going to teach you to knit. And so that's how she helped someone else, you know, like we talked about.
Right.
Nine, touch someone. Staying socially connected, we just talked about that a few minutes ago. So having these people around you is very important. Ann Hood knitted alone, but she mostly knitted in groups of people, and she wrote a book, a novel, in fact, called The Knitting Circle about it. Number 10, be grateful. You can't be grateful and angry all at the same time. The brain isn't that competent to do that. If you're feeling gratitude, you know, you're going to feel better. And there's so much to be grateful for after you go through a traumatic experience. You're alive, for one thing.
I have to tell you, go ahead. It was in the 90s when I was in the middle of this dangerous situation, and we did a workshop, and I saw a video of myself, and I realized, oh my God, I'm dying. And I, you know, what I'm doing isn't working. I need a new plan. So I said, I'm going to study I worked on Wall Street, and this is what investment bankers are taught to do. I'm going to study the story of everybody else that has, you know, been through this and see what worked and what didn't.
Uh-huh.
And so I went back and I studied, and what I discovered was the people who failed, who didn't make it because they were poisoned by their own anger.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I said, oh my God. And I was lucky. I had a great church that had classes on spiritual warfare, which completely taught you how to deal with all of this stuff without going to anger. You just, you know, and it saved my life because I learned, you know, one of my favorite preachers says, God does not need what you have lost to bless you.
Right.
And that's when I realized, oh, if you're alive and you know, you can put two shekels together and rub them together, you've got something that can grow into whatever it is you want. So, but it starts with being grateful.
Yes.
And you can't, it's a way of staying out and getting out of anger that is tremendous.
Yes, exactly. So that's number 10, be grateful. Number 11 is walk the walk. Act like you're better. It's interesting. You can find small things in your life that allow you to behave normally and not as if you're a victim of something. Just a second.
I love the quote here. I acted strong when I didn't feel strong, and before long I was strong. It's yeah. The woman who was attacked by the
right.
Was it the crocodile?
Yeah, right, a crocodile. There's a whole business in this book about mirror neurons. If you are with somebody who's smiling, you're more apt to smile. If you're with somebody who's depressed, you're more apt to be depressed. There's a whole explanation of how that stuff works. Likewise, if you stand up straight and walk with a purpose, you're going to feel better than if you slouch down and act like a depressed person. So walk the walk is all about engaging this system that I'm talking about.
Right.
Number 12, the last thing. Life is deep, shallow up. So this is about humor. Again, you can't be laughing and feel very angry. Villains don't have genuine laughs. They have fake laughs. But if you can laugh genuinely with your strong circle of friends and family, you're going to feel better. And this is all about feeling better. Because one of the problems with trauma is it makes us feel bad for long periods of time. And this cascades into all kinds of other problems, like your spouse doesn't want to be with you because you're depressed. So laugh, and this is a big part of healing.
Right.
As my wife says, go ahead and cry too sometimes.
I call it staying in a state of amusement, because if you deal with financial matters, then you have to look at things sometimes that are very negative.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I've come to believe that you can look at anything and take it seriously, but still stay in a state of amusement is kind of what the Buddha did.
Yeah.
So, well, that's it. Surviving Survival. That's a good one. I also just wanted to mention House of Pain, which is the a selection of essays, and they're extraordinary. I'm not going to go into all of them, but there was two that I just wanted to mention. The first one is remarkable, on Marion Prison. I wrote a book on, it was a case study of a private prison company, and basically the premise is that it's unbelievably expensive and not economic to use the prison policies that we have. They make no sense. But it's, you know, in my experience, the prison experience for most people is much more gruesome than I think the average person knows. And you do a remarkable job in Marion Prison of describing this extraordinary and very unhappy place. So maybe if you could just describe it in a few words.
Well, prison turns people into savage animals. And prison is there for two purposes these days. It's not about rehabilitation. It's about making money. So these prisons are run by private organizations that are making a profit off of this business. That's why we have so many prisoners in the U.S. And the second reason we have so many is it's to keep minorities away from the white people.
And away from the voting polls.
It's a horrible system, and most of the people in prison are black or Hispanic, and it's not because blacks and Hispanics commit more crimes. It's because we live in a racist culture. And in Marion Prison, I was given unprecedented access to this maximum security prison. It was the most maximum security prison in the country at the time. And I was basically given free run of the place, and I decided just to keep myself out of it and just describe what I saw and heard. And I did so, and divided it into basically three tiers. It's the administration, the people at the top of the organization, the staff, the guards and so forth, and the prisoners are the third tier. And the reality for those three tiers is so different that you might think you were on different planets.
Oh, you are.
The administration has no idea what the guards do. The guards have no idea what the prisoners do. And the prisoners are, you know, the brunt of all this ignorance, and really don't care what the other two are doing. They just do their own thing. So it was a fascinating microcosm for me.
And then one on the World Trade Center, which I thought was fascinating. I hadn't realized that you had headed down to Ground Zero right after it happened.
Yeah, well, I saw it on the TV like so many, and I thought, well, this is my job, you know, to bear witness to historic events. And so I got in my car and drove there with a friend of mine who's a photographer, and we spent a week or so at Ground Zero just talking to people, watching what was going on, gathering stories, and it was quite amazing. I was obliged to bear witness to this historic event.
Right. Well, if you're Lawrence Gonzalez, it's true. You have to go. Okay, so your new book, which I did not know about until we just talked beforehand, Flight 232. This sounds fantastic. When can I get it?
You can pre-order it online now. If you go to my website, lawrencegonzalez.com, it offers you choices of Amazon or an independent bookstore or Barnes & Noble. But anybody online who sells books is going to allow you to pre-order it at this point.
Okay.
If you go on my website, you can also see an increasing number of things that we're posting having to do with 232. A description of it. You can see the cover. You can read an excerpt. There is right now an excerpt of the book in Popular Mechanics, this month's issue. And there's a link on my Facebook page to it. So you can go to Facebook and search Lawrence Gonzalez, and you'll find my public Facebook page there. and link to Popular Mechanics, or you can just search Popular Mechanics and United Flight 232 and you'll see it. So in 1989, July 19th, a DC-10, fully loaded with 296 people on board, experienced the explosion of one of its engines. The DC-10 had one engine on each wing and one running through the tail. The one running through the tail blew up, and it threw shrapnel out, pieces of metal out, and the pieces of metal went through the tail and cut the hydraulic line. So this plane at 37,000 feet going 83% of the speed of sound suddenly had no steering. No steering at all.
Well,
what the captain did to save those lives is he closed the throttle on the left engine and opened the throttle on the right engine. As the plane was trying to roll over and dive into the ground, it rolled to the right. And by using this different thrust on the two wings, he was able to raise that right wing and prevent the plane from diving into the ground. And then for the next 44 minutes, the crew manipulated those throttles to keep the plane from diving into the ground and somehow made it to an airport at Sioux City, Iowa, where they crashed. And you can go on my webpage, lawrencegonzalez.com, and you can see a video of this crash. A newsman happened to catch it on video. And when you watch that video, you will say to yourself, nobody could have survived that crash. I mean, it is total fireball, breaking into pieces. The tail snaps off early in the sequence. You can see seats tumbling down the runway as people are thrown out of the aircraft. And it just looks hopeless. And yet, out of 296 people, 184 survived. And of those 184, about 130 just walked away. I mean, almost without a scratch. So I thought to myself, wow, these people are out there with their stories to tell, and nobody's ever asked them to tell those stories. Not only that, the crew is still alive because they survived the crash as well. The flight attendants...
What year was the crash?
1989. So it's the 25th anniversary this summer, and the book will be out this summer for that anniversary. And so I've told this story in a 360-degree, intensely detailed fashion so that you first start in the mind of a passenger, and then you go up to the cockpit, and you're with the pilot trying to keep the plane from diving into the ground, and then you go to the air traffic controller in the control tower, and you go to the nurses who are in the hospital preparing bandages and gurneys, and you go to, you know, you go from point of view to point of view to point of view, and it just keeps the pace going.
Right.
So it's really interesting because now with this excerpt in Popular Mechanics, I'm hearing from people. Like I just heard from an air traffic controller this morning. He said, my God, I never realized what was going on. I was up in the tower, but, you know, I never knew what was really happening inside the airplane.
Well, you know, it's funny because in a funny kind of way, they can never get closure because they only were part of the story.
Yeah, right.
Have they ever had a reunion?
Well, there have been reunions, yes. There were several. There was a first reunion and a second reunion, and then I'm not sure where they sort of ended. There were several of them, and then they stopped. And this year, I know they had a 20th.
I'm dying to watch the video, but it makes noise, so I can't play it while we're talking.
Oh, yes, it does make noise.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a...
Well, I've already ordered the book, so I've got to read this. I know the thing, and I'm saying this for the people listening now, your writing is incredible in the... You know, you can slow it down and take the reader into the head or the actions of a person and be with one person in that place, like, you know, so I can imagine in the cockpit or whatever. And it's as though you're there, and you slow it down and you take it into very meticulous detail, and then you can swoop right up to the big picture and the framework of what's going on. So you can go top, you know. It's kind of like you can go up and look at the big picture and swoop down and slow down and get into the details. So I would think and given the quality of your writing, this is going to be remarkable. So I can see.
Well, this is the book. My wife will tell you stories about me during this period of writing this book.
How long, Lawrence, how long did it take?
It's hard to say because so much of the research is spread over years of my life. You know, probably all the research that went into this book probably represents about 10 years of work. And then the actual writing of the book took about 2 years. And and I was pretty much chained to my desk for that period of time. I was doing 15-hour days, but I was having the time of my life because I was born to write this book. I mean, this is the finest project of my lifetime, and it was effortless. People would tell me their stories, and it was like I was just typing for them. You know, I'm the typist, and you tell me your story. And they just
I don't know. I can't imagine anything being better than Deep Survival, but if you say so.
it's a different kind of animal from Deep Survival.
Uh-huh.
Deep Survival invites your, you know, participation and is, you know, you might even call it a self-help book in a way, although I always wanted to combine literature with science. But this is pure, I mean, it's a pure rocket ride from the beginning of Flight 232, that's the title of the book. You know, it don't start it at 10 at night because you won't get any sleep.
Will we fly again after we read it?
Yes, and the interesting thing is it doesn't leave you afraid to fly. Despite mm-hmm. all that happens in the book, in the end you come away going like, wow, flying is really safer than I thought it was because so many different things had to go wrong for this crash to happen. All
right.
of these stars had to be in alignment or the crash simply wouldn't have happened. And
it sounds to me like a lot of professionals did a lot of things right.
Yes, a lot of people did a lot of things right. Yes, indeed.
It's always amazing to me when there's extreme circumstances, the way people will pull together and all the training comes out, and it's amazing what they can accomplish.
Well, and the heroism of certain people in this story is just remarkable. There were a bunch of kids on board, many of them traveling alone because of a special promotion that United had going on that day. And one of the people I interviewed was a 9-year-old boy traveling alone, sitting next to a businessman. And he was so scared that he couldn't cooperate, you know, that you're supposed to get in the brace position with your folded over and grabbing your ankles and keeping your head out of the way because things go flying when you are in a crash. And this businessman next to him pushed him down and placed his body on top of this boy and saved the boy's life. And the businessman lost his life in the course of doing that.
Mm.
So there's just stunning stories of amazing feats by people.
Heroism, yeah. Well, Lawrence, our time is up, but I can't thank you enough for this, and I can't tell you how much I enjoyed my weekend reading Surviving Survival, and I look forward to Flight 232. I think your work is really essential reading for life in a modern age, whether we're flying around or roaming in the wilderness. I will never go into the wilderness unprepared again, that I can say.
Back when Flight 232 comes out, just let me.
Absolutely. I will. I look. When am I going to get it? I've already ordered it. When am I going to get it?
You'll probably get it in late June. The official publication
okay.
is July 7th, but they usually honor the pre-orders first, so you probably get it late June.
Okay. Okay. Well, listen, you have a wonderful day.
Thanks.
And good luck with the. Are you going on tour, on the book tour?
Yes, well, we're going to Sioux City first for the 25th year reunion, and there'll be a big,
fabulous.
A lot of
yeah
there. So, yeah.
Okay, well, all the best. May this book do everything you want for it. Okay.
Thanks very much.
Have a great day.
Bye bye.